Fearless Voyager Radio. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers, psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. And once again, I think I have a really incredible show for you today. Today, we are going to speak with Richard Feather Anderson. He is a teacher, author, and speaker on the subject of geomancy, and he is a geomancer. Welcome to the show, Richard Feather Anderson.
Hello, thank you.
All right, I guess the first thing we need to do for those people who are listening is to find out what geomancy is, and I realize it's a big subject, so maybe you can just kind of give us an overall picture, and then we'll kind of look at each little section. So what is geomancy?
You're exactly right. It is really a vast subject, and I've tried to develop my own definition of it, touch everything, but why don't we start off just saying it's the art of harmonious placement, and as such, it's something that everybody does. Every time that you walk into a movie theater or a restaurant, you look for the right place to sit. And that, when you're doing that, you're practicing geomancy. You're using some inherent geomantic knowledge inside of yourself.
So you're saying that even though a lot of us don't know what geomancy is, we practice it, I guess, intuitively. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Because geomancy, as far as I can tell, is the oldest art form, or the oldest science, or the it's really the first art or science that human culture developed, because at the very beginning we had to figure out where the best places were to pitch camp, or which cave was going to be best to sleep in, where to hunt, where to gather food, and in doing those very basic survival pursuits, you're practicing what we now call geomancy. I have no idea what it was called in the past, and I suspect that they didn't call it anything, because it was just simply their way of living and relating to the earth.
All right, now the show would be over very quickly then if all of us were doing this correctly, because then we wouldn't have to know what it was. It must be that we don't know how to do this correctly, and that must be what your purpose is that right?
Exactly. We have forgotten this, and in fact, we've gone through the periods of cultural change, of industrialization, of changing our relationship to the earth, creating a capitalist economy that uses, extracts resources from the earth and thinks of them as commodities. I mean, all of those changes that happened that separated us from the earth as a living being were things that made us forget geomancy, or even, I mean, in most cultures, when they went through that shift, outlawed it, made it illegal, killed or imprisoned the geomancers of those days. So this happened in Europe, for instance, in the Middle Ages. It happened in China in 1912 after the overthrow of the emperor. All around the world, everybody practiced geomancy because you had to if you wanted to survive, if you wanted to find the best source of water that was not going to poison you, that was a good source, that was dependable, that was going to be there during a drought. You know, all these very essential things. Finding a place for your house that was not going to be swept away by a flash flood or by a landslide or an avalanche. And doing it so, and not only just finding the best place, but finding a place that kept you in harmony and connected to the earth, so that you weren't destroying the place that you live. It was a very ecological science. I think of it as the original sacred ecology.
Okay, you say that geomancy is concerned with how to live in harmony with the patterns of nature. These are the seasonal cycles, from ecological patterns that sustain life to the lay of the land, to the seasonal cycles, to the geometrical patterns found in the way that all the organisms grow. Maybe you could comment on that.
Well, that was one of my attempts to make a definition. May add a few other things to that, or just sort of give you the whole thing. One simple way of saying it is that it's the sum total of all of humanity's knowledge about living in harmony with the Earth. Okay. A little more complete definition that I've come up with is that it's the ancient, holistic, integrated system of natural philosophy and natural science, which we have used to keep our activities in harmony with those natural patterns, the seasonal cycles, the lay of the land, the ecological patterns that sustain life, and the proportions that are found in the way that all organisms grow. So that's the definition of it that I've come up with that seems to cover it the best.
Okay, let's talk about one, seasonal cycles. What is it that geomancy does, and what would we know about the seasonal cycles? Why do we need to know? We know that there are seasons and that there are cycles in the seasons. Why do we need to know something about that?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. One is, I mean, so far we've been talking about art of harmonious placement and talking about just finding the right place, but ancient peoples, ancient cultures really didn't separate time and place. So it wasn't just where to have a fair, a festival, or where to plant your crops. It was when to start planting and when to harvest. And so that's where the seasonal cycles part comes in. It's the timing, finding the most appropriate, auspicious timing to begin and end things, all of our activities.
Is the Farmer's Almanac a type of geomancy?
I suppose you could say that. All of the festivals that we celebrate in this country are pretty much all of them, except for the political national holiday sort of things, are festivals that were originally to attune us to the great cycles of the Earth, the cycles that are created by the fact that we're circling around the sun and that are the tilt of the Earth's axis is making seasons, and that there's the lunar monthly cycles that have an effect on tides and emotions and menstrual cycles, and you know, all of those things mean that there are, all those influences mean that there are certain times that are better than other times for beginning something or doing some activity.
You say that geomancy is concerned with finding the right time for the human activity. Astrology and divination come into play here, I presume.
Yes, and astrology, astronomy. They were originally unified, just one science, and they were split in the Middle Ages. Astrology, I think of as holding the explanation of the mechanics that are in astronomy. Astronomy just tells you about the movement of the sun and the moon and the stars, but astrology tells you the significance of those movements and the significance of those cycles.
Let's talk a little bit then specifically about what a geomancer does. After all, we're finding out about it, but you're a geomancer. What is it that you do?
Quite a variety of things.
Maybe I should be more specific. What is it that you know that I don't know?
Okay, well, we could go back to that first example I said about you go into a restaurant into a movie theater, and you, whether you're aware of it or not, each of us looks for the right place. What's different for me is that I am consciously aware of making those choices and of scoping out that environment and finding the place that is going to best support whatever activity I'm going to do. If I'm going to have a business lunch, or if it's getting together with somebody I'm just meeting, or you know, depending on what kind of relationship there is between me and the other person, I'm going to look for a different kind of place, perhaps. People, most men, if a man is a accompanying a woman to dinner, the man will usually sit with his, so that he's facing the door, and will be very uncomfortable if the waiter seats him with his back to the door. He'll get up and get in the other seat. Those are things we do instinctually. The main difference is that when you know the geomantic traditions and the lore, then you can consciously be making those decisions, which means that you're much more in charge, you're much more empowered.
Okay, now I need to interrupt you. What exactly do you do? I mean, I seem like I'm doing this over and over again, but I mean, do you carry a divining rod with you, or do you have, some type of crystals? I mean, what is it that you're doing when you're looking for your spot?
I am noticing the patterns of the place and finding the spot that makes a perfect fit between the activity and the patterns. It's like getting a tailored suit of clothes. The specifics are going to vary from one situation to another, depending on who I'm working for or what's going on.
Let's stick with the restaurant for a second, because I like it. I think it's pragmatic, and many of us have had the experience that you're talking about, and I think we really can feel this. The point is, let's say there's a spot that you like, someone sitting in your table. Should you wait, or should you take another spot that you don't feel comfortable with?
Oh, well, there's you don't have to find the absolute number one perfect spot. There's always lots of choices. That is similar to one of the sort of myths that exists about Chinese geomancy, that people believe that those practitioners will tell you to move if the place is not auspicious. In the tradition that I study, that's never the case. I've never heard my teacher say move. There's always something you can do to make the situation better.
All right, now tell me a little bit about feng shui.
Well, feng shui is where that little piece of information about that it's not good to have your back to the door comes from. Although I also bumped into the same thing in environmental psychology out of Western architecture tradition when I was studying that. When you have your back to the door, somebody, let's say we're still in the restaurant scene, each time that somebody comes through the door, you turn around to see who it is, to check it out and see, you know, who that is, or it goes back to things that are very instinctual that are still operating inside of each of us, that you want to protect yourself from. Is the person coming in the door a threat to you? And it goes back to when we lived in a very different kind of society, and there might be somebody coming through the door to rob you, or somebody attacking or something. And we still carry that stuff in us instinctually. It still fires off. So you're not completely relaxed when you got your back to the door, because you're hyper aware. You're noticing what's going on. Whereas if you're looking at the door and you're diagonally across from the room as far as you can be from the door, you're in the safest place, and so you relax. When you're more relaxed, you have more of a connection with the person you're with there at the restaurant. You're more yourself, you know, all the things that go with being more relaxed. So the place has, in the arrangement of the place and where you situate yourself in it, has quite an effect on your relationship with the other person, your interactions.
Now, you say the key principle in creating this sense of correct place is to establish a center or a boundary and a gateway. Well, what does that mean?
Well, again, that's now that we're getting into the nitty-gritty stuff, we get into the complicated part of it. It's like that, again, really depends on the situation. Let me think of a specific. If somebody comes to me, when somebody comes to me and wants help with designing a house, I will go through questions to get at the center boundary and gateway. the first question will be, what kind of house do you want? What's your intention in living in this place? Say they already have the property. I'm asking them a question about their center. Now, so I start there. What's your intention? What's your intended relationship with this place? What do you want to do there? And then I ask them to make me a list of all the activities. And I say, don't give me kitchen, living room, that kind of stuff. Give me what you imagine you're going to be doing there 5 years from now when you're in the place. Just paint me a picture of a typical week.
Now I want to interrupt. I mean, most of us don't even have the luxury of having a house built for us. We end up in someone else's place who they had it before us. So basically you're telling us that this is certainly the optimum situation, isn't it?
No, I'm just using one situation where you're starting out fresh with defining those center boundaries and gateways. The boundaries are which of the activities you really do want to house in the house and which are beyond your budget, or which activities, say you're going to put cooking and having guests together, that you like to do that. Well, then we have now eliminated, we've basically got the pattern of a large country kitchen or something with the eating space right in there. But I start with that idea of center and boundary and have them list the activities. And then the gateways are how you get from one activity to another. So this is the way, as a geomancer, that I approach designing a house, which is a little different than the way that an architect would go about it.
Right, because he's concerned with how the shapes fit in, let's say, with the surrounding environment, and you're concerned about what's going to be happening in the particular establishment. Is that right?
No, we're both concerned with the same thing. The approach is a little different. And I'm focusing on creating harmony in the relationships of the different activities and the people's relationship with the place. So I'm still concerned with the how the house fits on the land, but I will look at the shapes in the landscape and the lay of the land and suggest that the house mimic those shapes so that you don't, for instance, get a big, huge cubicle house up on top of a hill, you know, and it sticks out like a sore thumb, and everybody knows it and says, God, what an ugly house. Why did they do that? Well, that's not possible if you're coming from a geomantic perspective. The shapes, the lines of the hill will be carried right into the house so that it almost becomes invisible.
We are talking about building a house, which is very pragmatic. Once before when we spoke, I said, is this like the stuff that Don Juan was teaching Carlos Castaneda about finding your spot? And I forgot what you told me. What was your response to that?
Well, that's another one of the things that a lot of people have heard of and have some connection with geomancy. And yes, that is sort of a piece of geomancy. And it's finding, the kind of spot that Don Juan was talking about was a very particular sort of spot. In geomancy, we're trying to find the places that best support any activity. So it's cooking, the best place for sleeping, the best place for entertaining, socializing, going for a walk, whatever. So
right now, Carlos, of course, was looking for his power spot, if I remember correctly. Was that right?
Something like that. And it was a little bit ambiguous and vague in there as to exactly. I don't think they went into a lot of detail in describing that. But knowing that kind of shamanic tradition from the inside and from my own training, your power spot is not one simple thing either. Depending on, this gets back to center boundaries and gateways, depending on what my intention is, the spot that's going to support that is different. So if I'm looking for a vision quest place, that I'm going to be looking for a different kind of spot than if I'm looking for a sweat lodge place.
Okay, now most of us have pets. Pets do this, I guess, outside in the yard and around the house too, don't they?
Cats particularly. there are some traditions, particularly in China and Egypt, where they would notice where the cats preferred to lay, and they would not place their houses there.
I like that. In other words, just silence now. Okay, because, you know, I have watched my cat, for example, and I noticed that my cat has particular places that he goes and sits in at different times of the day, and that's why I brought that up.
Right, right. And that's part of the reason for studying geomancy is to make those sort of instinctual senses conscious. And that's what, when we were talking about the restaurant, it's the same kind of thing, that we go in and we make those decisions and we choose the spot, but we're not really aware of what we're doing. And in studying geomancy, you become aware of that, and then you can really use all of those senses and all those intuitions and add to it a whole lot of lore developed from centuries, thousands of years of observing things like the cats. The places where the cats like to be are places where, when humans are there for a long time, you don't sleep well or you develop different diseases or stuff. This is a very small side aspect or piece of the pie of geomancy that's really been developed over in Germany, where they've spent several decades using dowsers to douse for different types of earth energies, using doctors, medical practitioners, public health officials, and going through the epidemiology statistics and correlating that these places that the cats like and places where there's a crossing of what they call underground water that's detrimental to humans, that when people have their beds or their favorite chair on these spots that they call cancer spots, those people get cancer and arthritis and rheumatism and multiple sclerosis more than people that aren't on those kind of spots. This has been going on for a couple decades over in Germany, and a lot of people are aware of that over here, over there.
Well, of course, now a lot of people will be nervous wrecks because they want to know, well, am I sleeping in the right spot? Am I sitting in the right spot? I mean, is there anything that the ordinary person can do to find out?
Yes. If you notice you sleep better when you are sleeping outside the home, when you go to a friend's house or a motel or something, and you're having a better night's sleep, and you come back home and you didn't sleep as well as you just did when you were outside of the home, that's a pretty good indication that there may be something off on the location of your bed.
So I guess a lot of people, when they buy a house, obviously don't think of this, do they?
No, and I would, all of us in this field are hoping for the day when this becomes one of the contingencies for looking for a house either to buy or to rent. And as you were saying before, not too many people have the ability to start from scratch and build their own home. So geomancy and feng shui today in America is being used much more by renters and people buying existing homes, asking us to come and evaluate the place and analyze it before they sign the line and before they start to discover the problems. And I always say it's much easier either in designing or buying the new place or renting the new place. It's always easier to deal with any problems right at the beginning. It's when you're designing a house, it's much easier to change things on paper than once you start putting up the walls. And geomancy can, having the geomantic knowledge, can resolve a lot of those problems. Just because we simply know what to look at, we observe things that other people have forgotten to look at or not aware of.
Now, in the Vedic sciences, they have, I think, what is called Shtapya Ved. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it, so I'm not going to. But yes, and there is a branch of that tradition for temples and a branch for homes, which is typical around the world. Each culture has their own tradition of geomancy, and it's usually divided into homes and temples, and or a different, like in China, there's a yin feng shui and a yang feng shui, which is homes for the living and homes for the dead.
I suppose we could be suspicious then of the fact that any of those great cathedrals that are still standing after major earthquakes and during wars must have found their correct spot. Would that be a good assumption?
Yes, I don't know about the earthquakes. That's interesting. I haven't thought of that before. But all of the Gothic cathedrals in Europe are situated on sites that were sacred sites long before Christianity came into Europe. So they're on Druid groves or holy hills or sites where there was a megalithic ring, and they actually used the stones of the megalithic circle to create the cathedral. Shark Cathedral actually still has one of the standing stones down in the ground floor of the crypt level. Another thing is that almost all of those Gothic cathedrals were sited on a site that had a holy well, and they are usually what dowsers call primary water or blind springs. It's a source of water that's very, very deep, that's not susceptible to drought, that's absolutely pure, unpolluted, and it was essential for particularly when the cathedrals were inside of the walls of the medieval towns. You had to have a dependable source of water in order to survive a siege of the walled citadel there that the cathedral was inside of. So having, that's about as close as I can think of to something like earthquakes. Those towns were able to survive sieges because a geomancer had come along and found that source of water. And that became the center, as it were, of that settlement. Because we can't live without water. So the center of the settlement is often the source of water.
We need to talk a little bit about center, boundary, and gateway, and how it, you say, actually was the formation of the town concept then, right?
Yeah, those are the three elements of creating a sense of place. Without a center, boundary, and gateway, you don't have a place. You have no awareness of place. And so it has been with us since the very beginning. In order to, when the very first settlements were created, or even nomadic, just a cluster of tents, a center would be created. They find the spot or the source of water, like in the medieval towns, and then they would cluster around that.
Okay, now are you talking about the center of the town? They actually call it the town center.
Often the thing that we now call the town center was originally the well, and this is you can't see this very well in America. It hasn't been preserved because we hide our source of water in wells and stuff. But in Europe, most of the towns and villages, and even large cities, still have a well or a fountain that is in the town center, the Centre Ville, or it's right there, and that was what the town started around. It was because of a good source of water, and people would then camp or cluster around that. But then they either created a protective wall around themselves, or simply some kind of a perimeter that defined the space, the domain. So in order to create a place or a sense of place, you have to create that boundary, and that separates this spot from the background, from the environs.
Let me interrupt for a second. So if you look at the contiguous United States, what we are looking at is this concept of center, boundary, and gateway. Is that correct?
How are you thinking of it?
Well, for example, let's take an area like, Iowa. If you drive through that area, there's absolutely no way that you can tell the difference between Iowa Illinois, Indiana, I mean, the whole area out there. And yet, on a map, you see boundary lines.
Okay, well, that's a little different.
But there aren't they, okay, you say it's different. I was just going to say this is an invisible boundary in a sense.
Yes, and it's not a geomantic boundary. In geomancy, the whole crux of creating a boundary is creating one that is that coincides with some natural boundaries or is appropriate for whatever kind of activity you're trying to bound.
All right, let me interrupt. Then a state like New Jersey works because it's got a natural river along the side.
Exactly. I grew up in West Virginia. West Virginia is one of the few states that has all natural boundaries. It's all rivers and the top of a mountain ridge.
Okay, now I didn't want to, I don't mean to interrupt, but of course we are still talking about this formation of the town, or in this particular case, the city. But the boundary then, this is a, let's say, a correct, a geomantic, is that the right word, geomantic boundary. What would be the example of a gateway in the case of, let's say, West Virginia?
Well, actually, let's stay with the town, the medieval town. It's a little easier to imagine. The gateway there, the gateways were the gate towers, and there was usually a clock or a shield of the town or something that was right over that. A whole lot of different things are going on with just that simple element. That gateway, of course, can be closed, and you can control the goods and services and people going in and out of the boundary. The only way that you can maintain a boundary is by having a gateway. And yet, if you don't have a gateway, you can't get across the boundary and you can't get into the place. So the place is sealed off and it's not accessible and it's not really a place for us. So the boundary and gateway are two sides of the same coin. And the gateway is also the place where you get initiated into the place. So that when you come through that, if you imagine one of those medieval town gateways, there were flags flying, or there was the shield of the town, or maybe many shields of different guilds.
Actually, you know, it kind of makes me laugh. I'm thinking of New York City, where you're initiated by paying at the toll booth when you get across the bridge.
Yes, or when you come into a smaller, you know, you come into smaller towns, and it says, Kiwanis Club welcomes you to, et cetera, and you see all the names of the churches and the addresses on a little sign or something. It's initiating you to that place, telling you a little bit about the people that are there. And that's a gateway. A gateway is not just a place, it's an experience. It's an initiation into the place. But let's carry it a little further. Let's say that you've got one of these towns, and it's on top of a hill. There were a lot of hill towns in medieval Europe. And in, well, throughout America, that was a pattern as well at one point. So when you're, if we step back a little further, and you're approaching the town, you see it up on top of the hill. You see the spires of the cathedral, and you, that is in the center of town. So you're seeing the town, you're seeing the walls around the town, you're seeing it on top of the hill, and there's a boundary that coincides with this natural feature. But you're also, let's say you're seeing that from coming over a ridge or through a pass into this valley, and this hill is in the middle of the valley. You're coming through another gateway and another boundary, and that's the boundary of the watershed. And what they did, say, in the British Isles, is that each one of those watersheds was a parish. And this was also done with the townships in some places in New England, where they didn't just simply do a square grid. They followed the ridge lines, or they followed the rivers, or the center of the valley, or whatever. They used some kind of natural ecological boundary as the boundary of the political jurisdictions, the social jurisdictions, so that the people had, when they were creating their sense of place by creating the center and the boundary and the gateway, they were creating a sense of place of belonging, a sense of identity with the natural features, with the watershed, with an ecological unit, an ecosystem. That's a crucial thing that geomancy does that you don't find in the kind of grid county line layout that you have in the Midwest and the Great Plains. You have these totally arbitrary boundaries that don't mean anything, that don't connect you to the earth.
But of course, I mean, just in defense of that, there are areas out there where it would be impossible to figure out what you would do in order to make a boundary.
No, not exactly. You just have to be a little more subtle in what you're looking at. Water is always going downhill. And there are very few places that are totally flat and don't have any drainage. If the water drains to a low spot somewhere, and there are high spots, and so you can find, you can get out, you can walk the land, or you can look on a contour map, and you can see where the natural watershed units are. And those make a lot more sense as the boundary of a place.
Okay, let's come back to this idea now of center. You mentioned the term intention. Does a city then have an intention when they begin to make one?
Sure. I lived in Berkeley, California for years and years. That city was founded with the intention of only one thing, of being the seat for the new University of California. There are other towns which are created with the main intention of being a seaport, being a trade center at the crossing of the confluence of two rivers, like St. Louis. So most places get going because of some kind of intention, some kind of main purpose for that people have in mind for that particular place.
I guess now, because like attracts like, then like people will then gravitate towards that intention.
I'm sorry?
Because like attracts like, people who agree with that those intentions will gravitate towards that city then.
Yes, but it starts, it usually starts with the spirit of the place. And people simply come and recognize it and say, oh, this would be a great place for such and such.
Okay, so the point of geomancy is to recognize what the spirit of the place is before you create the place, which would be the reverse of how people create cities, I suppose, in the New World.
Exactly. Or just becoming a little, I think we do a little bit of that. We do, even when we're coming at it from a very economic or capitalistic point of view, we're still looking and seeing that Chicago, for instance, would be a good place for a hub of all the railroads. It was just in the right place in terms of the whole continent to be the place where at the southern tip of Lake Michigan, all the train routes would have to dip down around the lake there, and it was a natural hub, so it worked. St. Louis was a natural hub for steamship transportation, and so it became an incredible shipping, commerce, trade center because it was in the right place for that, and that place supported that activity. So people who had their wits about them recognized those qualities, that spirit of that place, and started to establish something there.
You've begun taking this a step further and calling it. Social geomancy, which you're going, I guess, trying to use for recovery work for abuse survivors, codependents, etc. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you think you can do with that?
Well, what I think I've bumped into is that these elements of placemaking are about, it's not just a sense of place, it's basic principles about a sense of identity. So it can be the identity of a town, but it can also be your self-identity. So you need to know your center is sort of is your goals, your purpose in life. What are you here to do? Your boundary is what can you do and what can't you do? What abilities do you have, and what don't you? You know, there's limits to how much you can get done in a day or a lifetime. So those are your personal boundaries. And your gateways is how do you get in and out of those things that you do want to do in your life. And the boundaries, what you're mentioning there about a lot of the recovery work and codependency work now is all about boundary work and figuring out a codependent person needs to the recovery process being used today is to get used to creating your boundaries, to exercise that ability, which people had given up the power of saying no. That's a boundary word. It says, no, you can't do that with me, to me, in this place, whatever. In order to make that boundary declaration, you also have to have some sense of yourself, which is the center of the intention. Say, no, you can't smoke here. I know I get a headache and get very dizzy and ill if you smoke. So there's my center is that my body doesn't handle it. I'm very sensitive to it. The boundary is no, you can't do that.
All right, now we are going to start running out of time if I'm not careful, so I need to get to two concepts. First of all, we've talked about the fact that there is dowsing. You say dowsing is not limited to finding water. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about what dowsing is and how you practice it as a geomancer.
Dowsing can be defined lots of different ways, and I suppose every dowser does say it a little differently. For me, it is an innate, inherent human ability to sense things that we're not consciously aware of. And so most people associate dowsing with the water witcher, with the person that comes out with forked sticks and finds a place for the water well. There are a lot of different tools that dowsers hold in their hands. Pendulums is one of them. And that are in L-rods or angle rods that are used. But actually, that's not dowsing. Dowsing is something happening inside of yourself. It's some intuitive or psychic ability. Using the tools, the Y-rods, L-rods, pendulums, helps exercise that, just like the training wheels on a bicycle. But once you've learned how to balance on the bike, you can throw the training wheels away, and then you're doing what we call deviceless dowsing. And so it is an extra sensory or skill. And the way I use it in geomancy is that I will go either on a map or on a property, and I will douse for those. Where are the appropriate, most appropriate places for each of the activities? Like, where is the best place to sleep, to cook, to eat, to et cetera? And I do that when I'm doing it on a map. I'll just use my pendulum and I'll mark each of the spots that I get, its center and its boundary. So I get a little zone, I get a bubble, a little circle or kidney shape or whatever the shape is on the map of all the different activities. And that's where the floor plan for the house comes from. And what I'm doing when I'm dowsing is I'm saying, Earth, spirit of this place, show me the places that will most support these different activities and create a harmonious relationship between these people and the place. And then I get the answers from going within and connecting with the place.
All right, this brings us really well to probably what will end up being the end of the show, and that is Earth healing. You have a particular direction with earth healing. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Whenever I hear that term or people saying we really have to heal the earth now, or I'm devoting myself to healing the earth, what I think of is that it's about healing our relationship with the earth. And that, with thinking of it that way, it becomes a little, you come up with different things you're going to do. A lot of people talking about earth healing are talking about, well, the Exxon Valdez spill, oil spill, or thinking of the toxic waste dump, or these things that we have to clean up. But I think I go to the foundation of that. What relationship do we have with the earth that has created lifestyles and ways of regarding or disrespecting the earth that even set up the situation where we could have oil spills or have toxic waste? How did we even get into that mess? Where did we get out of harmonious relationship? So I start there, and I start with things like, well, what are you doing with your waste, I say to people? Are you composting? Probably the most important first step for each of us to make in healing the earth is to compost all of our kitchen scraps, all of our lawn trimmings, to give something back to the earth, to change the relationship of take, take, take from the earth, and start to create a reciprocity process. What do we give back? What are we doing to sustain life on the planet?
Well, now, it just occurs to me when you say that, I mean, we have all these landfills. I mean, this stuff is going back in anyway. I mean, it's not like we're taking this stuff. I don't mean, I'm not, you know, trying to create problems, but we're not taking this stuff off the planet and putting it on another planet. It really does, in a sense, go back.
No, we're not giving it back to the cycle of life. When we put stuff, let's take a lot of the things that we put in the landfill are not biodegradable and do not break down, and so they just sit there. A lot of the things we put in are pollutants and will eventually get into the water table and pollute our water. And when we put, all of us, most people put their kitchen garbage and all the things that will decompose into these plastic garbage bags. That stops the decomposing process because there's no air getting into the garbage bag. So that stuff's just sitting there and it's rotting and molding rather than turning into soil. So the whole way we do it is not giving anything back to the cycle of life. We're not creating soil out of these things that we're discarding. When you go and all that stuff just sits there, you open up the garbage bag 10 years from today and it's still garbage. It's clumps of food. But when you do that in a compost pile, in 6 weeks you have soil, and it's rich with nutrients, and you can grow more food out of it. So it's a very different cycle and relationship. Does that make it clear, the distinction?
Sure. And you know, it's interesting too, because you have said that geomancy has not been allowed to evolve along with the Western society. How would it have evolved, or how should it be evolving at this point?
I think one of the most important things is something we touched on before, is that we need to redefine all of our county and state and national boundaries so that they are coherent with the natural boundaries of the land. And the reason for that is that if, say I take California for an example. In California we have several watersheds, but the main one is the whole ecosystem watershed of the Sacramento and San Joaquin River valleys, all the water coming out of the Sierras down through San Francisco Bay and into the ocean. That's one whole ecosystem. Most of that water in the last 100 years has been, a lot of it's been diverted to Southern California, which is desert, which is part of Baja California, Mojave Desert. It's a different ecosystem. If the boundaries of California were just the Central Valley, that whole watershed, then it would be much easier to make decisions with that whole ecosystem in mind. State of Colorado, for instance, had a much easier task with saying to Southern California, you can't use the Colorado River water anymore because it was coming, they were buying from a different state. But within California, there's been this war over water going on for the last 100 years because it is one state, but it's two ecosystems. So if we start making our political jurisdictions consistent with natural regions, with biological or bioregions, it'll be a lot, we will automatically, naturally start to think in ecological terms, because we're dealing with a center, a boundary, a place that is a natural center and boundary.
Richard, thank you so much for being on the show. You have a few moments. What would you like to say to everyone?
Practice geomancy. Start with just being aware of your environment all the time, and start to notice those choices that you make in going into the movie theater, into the restaurant, into renting an apartment. And just do experiments and start to notice how you feel in different places, in different spots, in different corners of a room, and start to teach yourself geomancy.
And as you have pointed out, this is not just some whim. This actually has an effect on our overall health and growth, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's what I would call the oldest form of environmental psychology, or the study of how environment, the shape of the environment, affects our behavior and our well-being. And that's really the crux of the Chinese geomancy. The feng shui has probably developed better than the other traditions. The observation, the collecting of centuries and centuries of observation about how different places and different arrangements of place create people who are healthier, wealthier, wiser, more self-cultivated, have better marriages and relationships, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole piece of that lore there that we didn't touch on that's very developed in that system as well.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, for being on the show. I really appreciate it, and I know that my listeners do too. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.